supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. With their win last night over Oakland, the Eagles clinched the number one seed in the NFC playoffs. Good news for Philly fans and potentially good news for some local businesses because the city now has a better chance of hosting two playoff games. More from WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
Fan Cave is a full-service tailgating experience. You pick the location and they'll bring the goods. A trailer, three big-screen TVs, even bathrooms.
Yeah, kind of give you everything you could and fit in your car.
Colleen O'Hara co-founded Fan Cave a few years ago. It's been 4 years since Philly hosted a playoff game, which means she's never been in business for an Eagles playoff run.
You know, January is only when we start winding down and resting and re-preparing for the next year.
Now Fan Cave is expecting a bird's bump. Depending on how many wins the Eagles rack up, O'Hara could be booked into early February. January is typically a slow time in the hospitality industry, says Larry Needle, with the Philadelphia Convention and Visitors Bureau. A few Eagles wins could deliver an extra jolt to the city's economy and its psyche.
It's really a win on many levels for us.
A win, but maybe not a rout, financially speaking, that is. When locals spend money on game day, they're often just redirecting cash that would have been spent at other neighborhood businesses. The real impact comes from outsiders who travel in for the festivities. An NFL playoff game can deliver a few thousand visitors, says Needle, but not as many as the Army-Navy game or the NFL draft.
When you're literally bringing tens of thousands of fans into the city, that said, it's still not insignificant.
One estimate, conducted the last time the Eagles hosted a playoff game, put the economic impact at $10 million per game. In the typically tight-fisted weeks after Christmas, that's the kind of green Eagles and non-Eagles fans can get behind. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
Addiction specialists are on high alert this time of year. WHYY's Alana Gordon reports there's a reason overdoses tend to spike around the holidays.
As a trainer of the overdose-reversing drug naloxone, Elvis Rosado is on the front lines of prevention in the Philadelphia region. But the days right before Thanksgiving last year were especially tough.
And I think it was that Thursday we had over 100 overdoses in one day.
Rosado reversed some of those overdoses himself through administering naloxone. He says overdoses often spike around the holidays. And one reason is people may stop using for a day or two around family and maybe take something to hold them over.
Whether it be a Suboxone or something else to hold off the withdrawals. And they don't realize that 24 to 48 hours of interrupted drug use changes the tolerance and it puts the person at risk.
When people go back to using, even after a break of just a day, they may not realize their tolerance for a drug like heroin has gone down. So their normal dose for a high could put them at increased risk of an overdose. Rosado says that's why it's even more important for people to not use alone, to check on loved ones who might be struggling, and to have naloxone handy, which no longer requires a prescription at the pharmacy. Alana Gordon, WHYY News.
The first year of New Jersey's ambitious bail reform effort is nearly over. The state was among the first in the nation to totally rethink its criminal justice system. Now, poor defendants are no longer stuck behind bars on small amounts of bail that they can't afford. And judges can hold particularly dangerous criminals in jail. That's something they could not do in the past. Nevertheless, not everybody's happy. Critics say the program allows dangerous criminals back on the street and provides no incentives for defendants to show up for court later. WHYY's Joe Hernandez has been covering this over the last year and joins me now. Joe, first off, bring us up to speed on what exactly New Jersey did to overhaul its criminal justice system last year.
In a nutshell, the biggest thing that they did was pretty much eliminate cash bail. Previously in New Jersey, when you were arrested, a judge would set bail for you, and then you would be able to pay that and get out of jail while you awaited your trial. But a study in 2013 showed that nearly 40% of people were stuck in jail only because they couldn't afford their bail. So people identified that as a problem and decided to change it. So now judges are looking at two things in this new risk-based system. They're looking at whether they think you'll skip a future court date and whether you might commit another crime while you're out on release. And to help them kind of decide that, they're using a computer algorithm that takes into account different things about you, previous convictions, current charges, and then spits out a score, a risk score for you. And judges, they're not bound by it, but they can use that to determine whether to keep you in jail or not. Cash bail isn't completely gone, but it's only been used, you know, a few times over the course of the entire year.
Okay. The new system enjoys the support of Governor Chris Christie, New Jersey Supreme Court Chief Justice Stuart Rabner, and a host of other elected officials and advocacy groups. Who are the naysayers and what are they saying?
Well, there are plenty of naysayers, but I'm going to talk about two kind of main groups, and that's county governments and bail bondsmen. And we'll talk about county governments first. They said that the new system was an unfunded mandate on county governments, and that's because the counties are responsible for paying for things like the prosecutor's offices, courthouses, and sheriff's departments, and they've had to kind of pump some more money into those things after this bail reform effort. They also have to pay for jail. And even though jails are seeing their populations drop, they aren't saving that much, according to the New Jersey Association of Counties. And that group is led by a guy named John Donadio. And here's what he had to say.
All of the cost savings at a county jail is really done through staffing. Even if there's a 15 or 20% reduction in the prison population, you know, counties purchase, it's like going to Costco. You purchase food in bulk. You purchase other, you know, goods and services in bulk. So any cost savings there is just nominal.
So the counties brought their fight to a board in New Jersey called the Council on Local Mandates, and they pressed their case there, but they eventually lost. And now there are the bail bondsmen. These are the men and women that in previous years and currently in many other states, a vast majority of states, would help you pay your bail and then you'd get out of jail. You'd have to pay them back and they would make sure you showed up for court and things like that. They say now without them in New Jersey, and they're pretty much gone in New Jersey because they aren't needed anymore, there's no one there to make sure that people show up for court, which is technically untrue because there's a pretrial services division of the state judiciary that's supposed to oversee that. And the bail bonds industry has funded two federal lawsuits to end bail reform in New Jersey, which are still working their way through federal court.
So now, almost 1 year in, has it been determined whether the system's working?
Not exactly. We know certain things and we don't know others. For example, one of the biggest things we know, which advocates say is a huge plus, is that the jail populations are dropping. They've dropped about 17% through October. And criminal justice advocates, activists see this as a sign that poor people who would have been stuck in jail are now out. They're living their lives, providing for their families while they await their day in court.
That sounds like a huge plus.
It is, but then there are things that we don't know, and that could be a huge minus to some of the critics of the system. So those things, for example, that we don't know yet are how many defendants are being released and then committing another crime while out on release, and how many defendants are being released and then failing to show up for court. And those were two of the main kind of arguments against changing this system. Advocates say it's kind of unfair to look at those numbers and compare it to a vacuum, because there was a system before this. Here's one of the people who was pushing for the reforms. Roseanne Scotti leads the Drug Policy Alliance in New Jersey.
You can't compare this system to perfection. You have to compare it to the system we had. Under the old system, people could be released on money bail and they might possibly commit another crime. Those things did happen.
So those statistics, whether people are committing more crimes while out on release and whether people are showing up for court or not, we don't have them yet, but the judiciary says it's working through them and they should be available in the first half of next year.
So in the process of anticipating changes going into the second year, let's factor in a new governor, Democrat Phil Murphy. Right. Is he expected to make any changes?
Probably not. I mean, Murphy has said that he intends to fully implement bail reform. That's something that he said during the campaign. His lieutenant governor, interestingly, Democrat Sheila Oliver, co-sponsored a bill before bail reform kind of took effect to roll back parts of it. And by that, I mean to allow money bail to still be used for certain defendants. This bill never went anywhere. There was some pushback to it, and it's unclear kind of whether she still holds that position or not. There are those two federal court cases I mentioned, which will continue working their way through the system next year. Also, kind of the other half of this effort, which hasn't been talked about as much this year because it's probably more applicable next year, are these new speedy trial timelines. So if you're arrested and detained before trial, now there's a whole set of timelines that the state has to abide by as far as bringing down an indictment on you, taking you to trial, and then the entire length from arrest to trial can't be any longer than 2 years.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks a lot, Dave.
WHYY New Jersey correspondent Joe Hernandez on Newsworks Tonight. On this day after Christmas, let's move on musically. Even the most sentimental among us surely has had enough Christmas carols to last until next year. To that end, we turn to the West Philadelphia Orchestra. They're a Balkan brass band that's been lighting up music venues, outdoor concerts, even weddings for over a decade. Baritone horn player Haley Varhol, percussionist Chad Brown, and singer Petya Zamfirova stopped by WHYY to talk about the various influences the 20 musicians bring to the group. An example of the way they blend Balkan, jazz, and New Orleans brass band music is their song Truck on Fire, which they played recently in their weekly show at Frankie Bradley's.
So not distinctly from any one place, and it's so distinctly of West Philly Orchestra, but you could still say that, yes, it is inspired by Balkan music. Yes, it is inspired by New Orleans brass band. Yes, it is inspired by, you know, electronic music. It's got all these wonderful things compiled.
Originally, once upon a time, Balkan music hailed from where? Turkey or Greece or Bulgaria or?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of all those countries, Bulgaria, Serbia. The inspiration, I think a lot of the inspiration for the orchestra, for the West Philly Orchestra, is started with Serbian and Bulgarian maybe music, and then we just began, as we kept being like curious about the styles in the region, we just kept exploring further and further. Now we've tried like some Turkish songs. I would love to do some Greek stuff. So it's just anywhere that we can crawl around there and explore.
Petya, you were originally from Bulgaria, so you have bragging rights to the extent that you were, as a youth, immersed in this style of music.
Yeah, almost not knowingly what it would do, what it would be for me in my life, in the rest of my life. I knew I loved it. I would jump on whatever chair or table so I can be shouting, and I'd be like waving my hands and dancing more and experiencing it to the fullest. And all of a sudden, I get to Tokyo.
Describe the Barry horn that you play. It's not a baritone saxophone.
Right, it's different. It's the baritone horn. It's a member of the brass family, and it's between a French horn and a tuba. It's a smaller version of a tuba that plays an octave higher than a tuba. And we play the role of like the rhythm guitar in the band. So there's three of us playing, and we're each playing one note of the chord. And all simultaneously, and we're playing rhythms, very, you know, usually very syncopated or fast.
What is the onus on the percussion to keep this all going?
We need to have a good balance of a very dyed-in-the-wool Balkan band would have, or Roma kind of percussion section would have, but also be really flexible and kind of understand, like, how can we mix in trap, right? How can we mix in drum and bass? Like, how can we mix in all these other things that'll keep our sounds fresh for not just ourselves, but also for an American audience? And the baritone horns, while they are in a very distinct pattern most of the time, they're always switching up their patterns. So whoever is leading in that section will just start quoting a new phrase or a new rhythm, and then they'll all sink into it. And then us as drummers, we need to figure out a way to, like, counteract that rhythm.
Or complement it.
Complement it. The biggest takeaway I've gotten from this band is becoming a very flexible musician and knowing how to use different tools and different sound tools.
Gotcha. Take us to the Tuesday night gig. Describe the scene.
We mingle with the audience. We are like a little family, like a house party in a way. It feels that way. Everything is very loose, very comfortable, very free. Whatever, leave everything at the door and just begin, you know, enjoying the music.
You know, we have this sort of built-in Tuesday night, and we have started partnering with different organizations that are local, and some of them are humanitarian or political or environmental or even pets. Philly Animal Welfare Society, the Philly Orchard Project. And what we've done is we've invited them to share the evening with us. So they invite their people and we invite our people, and we have an opportunity to share our music with their community, and they have an opportunity to share their project and their passion with our musical community.
And a portion of the tickets for that night goes to their organization.
Yeah, we use that as a way to raise money for their organization as well.
Baritone horn player Haley Varhol, percussionist Chad Brown, and singer Petya Zamfirova of the West Philadelphia Orchestra. They perform Tuesday nights at Frankie Bradley's. Winter in Pennsylvania is marked by a series of hunting seasons. For many of families across the United States, hunting or shooting for sport is a passion that's passed down the generations. But Chris Davis, who grew up shooting with his dad, eventually had second thoughts about carrying on that tradition. Chris shared his story earlier this year for our storytelling show, Common Space. It's a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY.
One day, my mother entered her bedroom to find me sucking on the barrel of a gun. I was an infant and had just learned to crawl, and I had found the gun underneath the bed. And she told me this story when I was in my 20s. She said she came over to me, and she saw me, and she said, "Christopher, what is that?" And she slowly took away the gun from me. And she said at that moment, she wanted to kill my father. And she went outside, and she confronted him, because it was his gun, and he had left it there. And when she told me this, she said he was very upset, too. But the gun had been loaded, and they had divorced 3 years later. I first shot my first gun when I was 9 years old. My father took me to the gun range. The gun I shot was a rifle. I weighed less than 70 pounds, and the rifle weighed around 10 pounds. And one of the things they don't show you in the movies is the kickback to the gun, or a recoil. All the force that goes to sending the bullet out actually comes back at you. So the first time I shot a gun, I actually fell over, and the gun was in the air. And my father picked me up, and I shot again, but this time I was prepared, and I knew how to deal with the recoil. My father does not have a lot of decorations in his house. He has two trophies, however, and they're these little trophies, this sort of fake gold enamel from Chevron. And he was part of a gun club, and these trophies are for accuracy. He had won them both, and he never, ever talked about them. He has over 30 guns in his house, an arsenal, everything from a semi-automatic rifle to a musket pistol. And I shot nearly every single one of them through my childhood until my early 20s. My favorite was the musket pistol. And the reason I loved it is because when you shoot a musket, it doesn't go straight. It rarely goes straight. It actually veers off to the side. And so you actually never know where it will go. With the rest of the guns, we were always sure I'd have this pinpoint accuracy. The first gun he gave me was a pellet gun, and he put a scope on top of it. And I would shoot tin cans on the side of his house in Oakland, California. And I would shoot for a while, and these were one of the few moments I actually spent with my dad of a shared activity. And one of the few times he would actually give me praise. And he would always say the same thing. He would say, "Good eye, son." When I was 14, I moved to Pennsylvania with my mother. And I soon realized, with the distance and the time away from him, I realized I actually didn't like to shoot guns. I realized that I had never wanted to shoot a gun. The only reason I had shot a gun was because I wanted to spend time with him. And so I had done it for many, many years. And when I would go to visit him occasionally, he would always want to go back to the gun range, and he would always want to go and shoot again. And I would do it for a while. I would humor him. I would go with him. But eventually, I didn't want to do it anymore. And the last time I shot a gun, we were in a canyon in the Sierra Mountains, and it was a semi-automatic rifle. And a semi-automatic rifle, you can actually take the trigger and just go like this, and 30 bullets will come out. It's incredibly powerful. And the thing about a gun they also don't talk about, when you do have it in your hand, is you experience a sense of power that is unlike anything else. And you realize that you can end anyone's life, including your own, in a single instant. In that moment when I was shooting the gun, I looked over at my father, and I am ashamed to say this, I briefly fantasized of shooting him. And this fantasy terrified me. It was terrifying to think. And I even went through the whole scenario, going to jail, all the consequences, ruining my life, killing him for no reason. And so I decided then that I didn't want to do this anymore. But I took one last shot of that gun in the canyon, and I heard the familiar words, "Good eye, son." Thank you.
Chris Davis is a writer and actor based in Point Breeze, Philadelphia. He was selected as one of Billy Penn's artists to watch out for. Check out Common Space. It's a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY. The next episode airs Sunday evening at 8 on WHYY-FM, and you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader, with help this evening from Joe Hernandez. End-of-the-year charitable giving is on many people's minds. In fact, nearly one-third of donations to nonprofits are made in December. And tomorrow evening, we'll meet members of a local foundation empowering high school girls to decide how that money should be spent. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.